On this Earth Day 2019, what do you think? Are we going to make it? Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Robiak. First, let me say I hope everyone had a wonderful Passover and Easter. I'm sure you had many interesting family discussions. I know I did. Maybe one of them was about the environment and our future. Those who care about the environment have been talking about it, but more importantly, doing something about it for a long time. Now, environmental historians are pretty much in agreement that the movement really started to come together and become widespread with the first Earth Day, which was back on this day in 1970. And I'm not joking now. I still remember some people calling Earth Day participants tree-hugging hippie freaks who needed a shower and a job. Those were the days, huh? Fast forward to 2019. Earth Day is now embraced by many non-freakish types, many who are extremely worried about the world and what will be left to their kids and their grandchildren. Earth Day and our environment is our discussion today. We'd like to get your thoughts. Our email is tfs@wshu.org, and you can find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. We're going to start our show today by talking with Adam Rome. Professor Rome is an environmental historian. Before he became a professor, he was a journalist, and he wrote the book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Today, Professor Rome is a professor with the Department of History at the University of Buffalo, and he joins us on Skype. Professor Rome, welcome.
Welcome, Ron. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So, Professor, we have met the enemy, and he is us.
Pogo. That cartoon was everywhere in 1970.
It was. It's all one of my all-time favorite cartoons. Still relevant today, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that's so different about the environmental movement from a lot of the other social movements. There's not just a simple enemy. We're all part of a system that works great in some ways, but's unsustainable in others. And we have to figure out how to deal with that.
Can we go back to the beginning just a bit? Where was the first Earth Day held? How did it come together?
It was held everywhere, which was really astonishing because the idea for it came from a 50-something senator, not at all a hippie freak. He showered regularly. He was a pillar of the establishment, but he'd been trying for about a decade to get the environment, protecting the environment at a time when the country was way, way more polluted than now.
We're talking, just so I could clarify a little bit, we're talking about Gaylord Nelson.
Gaylord Nelson, right, senator from Wisconsin. So he was really trying to get this to be a top priority for the country, and he hit on this idea of what he called an environmental teach-in that would be a kind of politicized academic discussion that he hoped maybe would be on 40 campuses. And it turned out to be virtually every college, every university, virtually every K-12 school, hundreds of communities, millions of people. And it still amazes me that a senator could have started all that.
And what really, I think, kind of galvanized a lot of what was going on back then, because there was an oil spill right off of California.
Right. A year before, a little more than a year before, in January 1969, the first awful televised oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara really helped make people think that affluence, great as it was, also had unexpected problems, and so did modern technology. And Nelson had flown out there months later to see the legacy of the spill, and it was on his way back to Washington that he had this idea that he would call for a nationwide environmental teach-in. The name Earth Day, by the way, came later. It was from an advertising agency, a hip advertising agency that youngsters, 20-something folks that Nelson asked to help him organize the event had contacted. And as I say, he originally thought it would just be on college and university campuses, but it quickly exploded. And people had this real sense that we had an environmental crisis, that if we didn't do something, and now for the first time, they could really see what they might do.
So it was an environmental crisis back in 1970. In comparison, how would you describe what's going on today?
Well, on the one hand, Earth Day worked. Our air and our water are much cleaner. People can't just dispose of garbage. Companies can't just put their hazardous waste anywhere they want. So we made tremendous improvements. But on the other hand, people weren't really yet thinking in 1970 about climate change. They weren't really thinking as much about other global challenges that we face, like the loss of biodiversity. So I think if Nelson were still alive today, I wish he were, he would want us to have the same kind of serious, soul-searching conversations about what this really means to us, how it's going to change our lives if we don't address these issues, and what we're willing to do individually and collectively.
And you know, not just to get completely off track, but I know you were saying a lot of people weren't thinking about, okay, our future 50 years from now, we could be in big trouble. But a short time after that, according to documents that we've seen, some of the executives at oil companies and scientists and so on were seeing at that time changes, and they kind of knew what was coming all the way back then.
Right. Well, even on Earth Day 1970, a lot of newspapers had a little teeny story about a meteorologist speaking at a national conference saying the climate was changing, it was warming, and that we needed to do something about it. But Earth Day was well before that first Earth Day, climate change became a public issue. Scientists knew about it. As you said, some corporate scientists too knew about it. But it really wasn't for another 20 years, another generation, before it became a huge part of the public discourse. Mm. And it's appalling to me that it's been another almost 30 years since then, and we still haven't done as much as we need to.
Professor, you know, I think it's fair to say that many of us would describe ourselves as environmentalists nowadays, maybe not with a capital E, but maybe with a small E. We try to do the right thing. You know, we try to recycle, try not to pollute. But the forecasts for the future just seem to be so dire. At times you go, wow, is it even worth trying, because we're in such a mess right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, until the worst happens, there's still hope that it won't. And I think the one other huge difference, Gaylord Nelson himself, he was interested in a lot of other issues beside environment. He was interested in social justice. He was interested in trying to stop the war in Vietnam. But I think it's even more imperative now that we think of this as something that requires much more than people who self-identify as environmentalists. You know, we need green buyers for Walmart. We need green accountants. We need green chemists. We need all kinds of people to be thinking, even if they don't consider themselves environmentalists, that they can do their part, either at work or in their home life or in their communities, to help address all the many, many challenges, the dire challenges, as you said, that we face if we continue to do very little.
Professor, how many people do you think are celebrating Earth Day today?
That's a really interesting question. Earth Day's changed. There aren't as many public events, big demonstrations as there were in 1970, or for that matter, 1990, the 20th anniversary. And there also aren't as many places where people are getting together to hear conversations. You know, that first Earth Day, some of the speakers spoke in the basketball arenas of universities with 15,000 people listening. So that's not happening today. But I bet millions of people are still thinking about what they might do. School kids are definitely thinking about it. And a lot of communities have what's now kind of a green trade fairs, a chance for you to see the latest green products and services. But I wish we were having more conversations. Mm. Many of the discussions on that first Earth Day were soul searching, and we've largely lost that, although I see signs that a deeper, more heartfelt conversation is beginning. David Wallace Wells opens his new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, with a sentence I can't put out of my mind. It's worse, much worse than you think. Well, what should we do if we accept that? New teenage activists are also challenging us, like Greta Thunberg. Do we really care about the future? And if we do, what's the best way to demonstrate that? I think each of us has to come to our own answers to those questions. I don't think there's any one right way forward. But I'm sure that change begins when we ask ourselves hard questions. Millions of people did that in 1970, and we need to do that again now.
There was a poll that came out. I'm pretty sure that you saw it. It was on NPR just a short time ago, and it said that basically most teachers don't teach climate change. And to show you how things have changed, and the results of the poll was 4 in 5 parents wish they did.
Oh, that's great. And I think parents are finally beginning to wake up to the fact that their kids are going to really have to deal with this. Their whole lives are going to be shaped by the many, many changes of climate change. And some of them we can't reverse at this point, but we can certainly try to prevent the most dire things. And I think anyone who really cares about the future, who has a kid or a student or anyone else they care about, who's young, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, it's almost unimaginable what things will be like if we don't really get serious now, right away.
So, Professor, I have 1 minute left. You and I are going to be talking 10 years from now. What do you hope to see in place?
I hope to see that we'll be proud of how much progress we've made toward changing the energy that we use to building a more sustainable society, a more sustainable economy, where all the incentives point to doing the right thing, unlike now, where many of them still lead us to degrade the environment and to leave problems for future generations. That's what I hope. And I think there's a good chance.
Adam Rome is environmental historian and professor with the Department of History at the University of Buffalo. Professor Rome, we appreciate your time today. Happy Earth Day to you.
And to you too.
Thank you very much. If you would like to join in the conversation, you can email us, tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Twitter. Go to our Twitter page. We're at Full Story WSHU. And of course, we're always willing to take your phone calls, 833-CALL-TFS. That's 833-225-5837. It's the Full Story on WSHU. A short break. We'll be right back. It's the Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. Today we're talking about Earth Day, which is today. What was it like back in the old days of 1970? And where are we going? Where's our future? Let's bring in one of the fathers of the environmental movement, Connecticut native, former presidential candidate, Ralph Nader. Mr. Nader, as always, we thank you for your time. Thank you, sir.
No, you're very welcome. Earth Day today.
Earth Day. Makes you feel good, doesn't it, huh?
Well, it's even bigger problems, it seems, with climate disruption. At that time, in 1970, it was more air and water pollution.
What was the feeling like back in 1970? Did you feel that you were part of a if you will, a counterculture movement, or did you feel that you were giving birth to something?
Oh, it was huge. There were 1,500 events at 15 colleges and universities on April 22, 1970. It was the cover of Time and Newsweek when that was a big deal. It led the network evening news, ABC, CBS, NBC, and it helped our movement to pass the historic Air Pollution Act and Water Pollution Act and establish the Environmental Protection Agency and even the Environmental Council in the White House. And this was all under Richard Nixon. So you can see when people really produce a rumble out there, even someone as reactionary as Richard Nixon signed one bill into law after another with a flourishing introduction.
You know, and this was the way it was back then. A whole bunch of the country looked at the environmental movement as being run by a bunch of weirdos. They wore bell-bottom pants. They had tie-dye shirts. And here it is. You come into the middle of all of this wearing your suit and tie. You didn't exactly fit the mold to change things, did you?
Yeah, but remember, the pollution was extremely visible to regular people. People didn't have to go out of their way. Streams were colored with industrial dyes. They were polluted. Fish kills were everywhere. You had air pollution inversions that made headlines, like in Donora, Pennsylvania, where people were choking, or in Los Angeles area. I mean, you could really see the pollution. And, of course, the engines of the automobiles were spewing forth all kinds of guck that they are under restraints and doing so today. So, you know, you'd walk down the street and a car or truck would go by and envelop you in a fog of pollution. So this wasn't something, you know, that was a hippie, just for hippies. Everybody was exposed. People couldn't wear a dress shirt in Pittsburgh for more than a day, and it was sooty.
Mm.
So am I conveying what it was like in those days?
It was a mess. Look, I grew up in the city, and I remember, you know, at times we would joke about being able to walk across the East River and the Gowanus Canal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a river, the Cuyahoga River, still there, right outside of Cleveland, that caught fire once in a while because it had so many oil slicks on it.
It gave Cleveland a black eye for a long time. It's a beautiful city now. Could I ask you about what's going on today? But I need to reference it back to what you were doing just a short time ago, because you were a leader in the no-nuke power movement. And I need to talk about something that just happened here in Connecticut, because you're a Connecticut native. You're a resident of Connecticut. And last week, Connecticut's governor, Ned Lamont, said he was very happy. He was pleased that a deal had been reached which will keep the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant open for another decade. What do you think when you hear that news?
That's corporate socialism. That's, pushing a plant that should be closed 10 more years on the back of Connecticut taxpayers. Let's see if they disclose the deal. They've been negotiating this under Governor Malloy, and they never disclosed it under the Connecticut Free Information Act because they said it was still being negotiated. So let's see. And our community lawyer, Charlene Lavoie, up in Winsted, is ready to read it line by line. But again, you see, this is the kind of dictatorial decisions that are made. Why should this decision be made by the governor? It should be made in open public hearings or even a referendum, since the taxpayers are going to have to pay, in addition to being ratepayers, paying ever higher electricity rates. And see, what they don't realize is what they're putting into the Millstone could be put into weatherization for homes and buildings around Connecticut, creating good-paying jobs and doing it much quicker and much more efficient and much safer. Because, you know, a gallon of home heating oil you don't burn is a gallon of home heating oil you don't have to produce. So weatherization, energy efficiency, call it what you will, energy conservation, decentralized, creates jobs and works year after year, without worrying about a meltdown or a disaster coming out of the Millstone plants.
Mm. But Mr. Nader, what I'm going to take the opposite side just to get your thoughts on this, because we're doing a program later this week, and I think it's going to be an interesting program, and we're calling it Green versus Green, where you have to make choices, and which choices are you going to make for the environment? For instance, wind turbines being put up off the Atlantic coast and what that's going to do to the marine life. But one of the arguments that I've heard for the last few years is that we should keep the nuclear power plant still operating for a while, not forever, while we incorporate geothermal, solar, wind, and slowly but surely take ourselves off of gas and oil and get rid of the carbon. And nuclear is just one of the aspects of that policy.
Well, first of all, you want to play nuclear Russian roulette? I mean, look what happened in Fukushima. The Indian Point plants 30 miles north of Manhattan in Westchester County on the Hudson River, they're near an earthquake fault, for one. They're aging, two, and the governor and the state of New York is going to close them down. That's a major contributor to electricity in New York, and they're going to be closed down in 2 or 3 years. So what are they thinking? What they're thinking, obviously, is energy efficiency is the big ticket. What you don't waste, you don't have to produce and sell to consumers. It puts money in consumers' pockets, and it creates good jobs at the community level, weatherizing homes and buildings, and all kinds of ways that people can do it to spread the cost, credit risks. Walter Hang of Ithaca, New York, toxic targeting is the name of his firm. Toxic targeting. He's got it all worked out. It could be passed in Albany or Hartford right away. It's a great jobs program, and it replaces nuclear power. So it isn't a matter of nuclear power versus coal. It's nuclear power versus reducing the waste of electricity, which is enormous. You know, I had one engineer years ago. He asked me a the leading question. You said, what's the principal function of an electric generating plant, whether it's oil, gas, coal, or nuclear? I said, you tell me. You're the engineer. He says, it's to heat the heavens. That's how much waste. Before it even starts wasting on its way to where you live and work. So the technologies are known. We've saved a lot of energy compared to 1975 over the years, but the opportunities are immense, and that's the first item of business. Save it, don't waste it. And then you go to moving to the conversion point you did on solar energy, all different kinds, solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, and one that's very rarely mentioned, which is passive solar. That is, you build your homes and buildings in ways that reflect 2,000-year-old Persian knowledge and maximize the sun in terms of your architecture in the winter and summer. And then, of course, there's geothermal. There is tidal waves, the Bay of Fundy. And, of course, wind power. Like, wind power can do the whole job. I mean, once they develop a grid system, North Dakota, Montana, South Dakota can provide a huge portion of electricity, just the wind coming out of those states.
It's happening.
And by the way, on offshore, the higher you go, the more wind energy you produce. So you can reduce the number of the windmills offshore depending on their height.
It's happening around here, I know, with the wind turbines. I was driving across I-80 in Pennsylvania just the other week, and I was amazed at the amount of turbines that I saw up on a ridge, which actually made me very happy. But at the same time, I also get pessimistic, and I have to be honest with you, because even just this morning, I go on weather.com just to get the latest weather forecast, and their first story on their main page is about climate change, and I just want to read to you a little bit of some of the numbers. It says there's a new United Nations report that 62 million people worldwide were impacted by extreme weather in 2018, and 2 million were forced to relocate to other areas as man-made climate change worsened. So with all this news that seems to come out every other day, and you being Ralph Nader, how can you stay optimistic in light of just what seems to be such dire predictions?
First, I don't use the word climate change. It's too benign. When I was growing up in Connecticut, you know what climate change was. It was summer, autumn, spring, winter.
Exactly. You
know, or winter, spring.
Yeah. Pull out the sweater.
Look at the description you just gave, and what you could have added, where now there are tens of thousands of people who die every year because of climate disruption. I mean, just think of flooding, for example, hurricanes all over the world, cyclones. So it's not just economic, it's not just climate refugees. So I like to use the word climate disruption or climate crisis or climate catastrophe. The second is, and you asked the essential question, what one institution that we can control and nobody can stop us can turn this country around and lead the world in transforming energy to energy efficiency and all forms of solar energy? Which will deal with the global warming issue. What is the one institution? You tell me.
I'm guessing it's us.
It's Congress.
Oh, it's Congress. See, well, it's us.
It's 535 men and women, Senator Blumenthal, Senator Murphy, Congresswoman DeLauro, Congressman Hines, Congressman Courtney, Congressman Larson. They are the ones who can do it. And we are millions out back. And if we focus and organize the vote, summon them to our town meetings, back in Connecticut and elsewhere, New York, where they have to face up to it, we present them with the transformation and conversion agenda, and they go back and they follow the orders of the people. There's only 535. We all know their names. They're not a huge bureaucracy in the executive branch. And if there's one thing they want more than the money they get from ExxonMobil or some electric company, it's your vote. But if your vote is not conditioned, if it's not laser-like, then they're going to say, well, it's easier to take campaign money from the fossil fuel industry and get reelected. So I tell environmentalists all the time, You're great on marches, demonstrations, lawsuits. Laser beam that energy right on your two senators and representatives. Mm. You'll see how fast the action is. It has not been done. And that's why year after year, nothing is done, because Congress is the one that can make it happen. Sure, you know, we can turn off the lights when we don't need them and lower the temperature, and that's all important. And we can walk, a couple blocks to taking a 2-ton SUV. That's all important. It's important to preach what you practice. But most important, in terms of speed, and you know as well as anyone, speed is now of the essence. We've got to get Congress moving, and they can get it done. They've got the power, and they have our delegated power of we the people, the sovereignty. So that's what we have to do. Congress, it's the Congress. Every time you hear somebody talk about climate disruption or climate catastrophe, just say, what are you doing about your two members? Are you summoning them back? You three members, two senators and representatives, are you summoning them back to your own town meetings, not their town meetings where they choreograph, your own town meetings, and you fill the seats in the auditorium or in the town hall? You know what I'm looking at now? I'm looking at a report, 1993, signed by Bill Clinton and Al Gore on climate change, is what they called it. It is devastating. It's like it came out today. It was urgent. It was colorful. It had the graphs. It had the data. And then they spent 8 years in office giving the auto industry a free ride, not requiring pollution control advances and more fuel efficiency standards. So you see, that's how long we've been asleep, and there are a lot of historians that say we were first warned about this in the 1940s by the scientists.
Mm. It's nothing new. I just want to also mention that a good chunk of our audience is on Long Island, so when you're talking about congressional representatives, for us, that's also Zeldin, Swazi, King, and Senators Gillibrand and Schumer.
Sure.
Mr. Nader, we have some youngsters coming on later in the program, just a short time, in a few minutes from now. They're leaders in the youth movement for the environment. What's your message for them?
I just wrote a column last week on that. Basically, the big push is going to come from 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds. They have the moral authority to look at the parents in the eye and say, why aren't you protecting us? Why aren't you doing what you know you should be doing? Why aren't you putting pressure on members of Congress? And if you're part of a coal company or an oil company, how can you continue in this kind of work? How can you not push for solar energy and energy efficiency? Now, all over the world, as you know, I guess it's about 1.5 million youngsters have demonstrated in the last few weeks, England, Sweden, India, various places, South Africa, and in the United States. And that's going to be a huge force. There's no question about it. In the past, youngsters looked their parents in the eye and when they were smoking and say, Mommy and Daddy, why are you smoking? I want you to be around when I grow up. Can you imagine the impact of that? I mean, I've had parents say it's just, they just ran to their cigarette pack and threw it in the garbage and never smoked again. That was a six-year-old. So, and the same with seatbelts. Once the youngsters know what the safety pathway is, and these youngsters are demonstrating now, they're applying what they're learning in school about global warming. Exactly what we want them to do. So you hit the nail on the head. Just have these youngsters go to nader.org, download my article on the children's movement against climate disruption and their moral authority vis-a-vis grown-ups, nader.org.
Once again, N-A-D-E-R for the kids, N-A-D-E-R, just in case you don't know how to spell that one, .org, and you can get the article. Ralph Nader is one of the fathers of the environmental movement. He was back at the beginning, and he helped start everything that's going on today with Earth Day, and he's a former presidential candidate. Mr. Nader, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program with us. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for your intelligent programming, and anybody who wants to focus on members of Congress, I put out a fable, which actually is an instructional manual called How the Rats Reformed the Congress. you go to ratsreformcongress.org. You'll get a whole tutorial on how to set up in your congressional district a Congress watchdog group. Piece of cake. It's easier than we think.
Mr. Nader, thank you, sir. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today is Earth Day. And today, naturally, we're going to be doing this actually all week. We're talking about the environment. My thanks to Ralph Nader for being with us the last few minutes. Now let's bring in Scott Chasky, director of Quail Hill Farms in Amagansett, Long Island, and senior advisor at the Peconic Land Trust. Scott Hath, also executive director of Environmental Learning Centers of Connecticut. And as I mentioned, we were going to be having some youngsters with us, and we'll get them on in just a few minutes from now. Lilia Bartolato and Joanna Ziegler, who are students at Sayville High and members of Students for Climate Action. We're going to find out how the younger generation, hopefully, keep the fingers crossed, rub the rabbit's foot. Hopefully, they'll save us all. But let's start it off right now with Scott. Scott Chasky, happy Earth Day. Is this day kind of like Christmas for you, Scott?
Yes, it certainly is. It's actually, I would say that every day is Earth Day for me. So I'm happy that it gets an official recognition as well.
But before I forget, I want to encourage everyone, because I went on last night. You have a fantastic website. So does Scott Hath. And so we'll make sure that we give those websites on our Twitter page, and we'll put them out there for everybody to go to them, because they're wonderful and really
you.
And really well done.
Thank you.
And speaking of that, Scott, I noticed that with your website, a lot of kids were in the photos, and obviously you have programs that are geared toward the youngsters. Are kids a lot more aware of the environment than we were?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, kids of all ages, and we've been, you know, we're a not-for-profit, part of a conservation organization. We run a CSA, a community farm, so we've always entertained kids of any age here, and thousands of them over this is our 30th year.
Wow.
But we also run an advanced apprenticeship program. So we actually each year are hiring new young people, basically in their 20s, to come and learn this type of agriculture and then go out and continue it somewhere else or start their own farm or whatever. And in the beginning, we had to hunt for people, and we don't have to do that anymore.
Not anymore. You're turning them away, huh?
Yes, we are. Yeah. So, I wish they could all. Wish we could welcome them all, but anyhow.
Scott Hath, they have just been celebrating 30 years out on the island, and you are celebrating 50 years in Connecticut, right?
That's right. Yeah, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary of inspiring the appreciation and enjoyment of nature. We focus primarily on elementary school kids up through sixth grade. And, you know, we try to get them outside and to learn what nature has to offer. And though I find them to be very, very excited about that once we get them out, the trick to us is to actually get them outside with the competition that we have nowadays with, electronics and computer games and video games and all that sort of stuff. That seems to be right now our biggest competition. So, you know, it's our challenge to inspire them to get outside and to learn what nature has to offer.
But to be frank, I think that's a challenge across the board. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning, and it was about kids who just aren't interested in owning cars anymore or driving out to see friends at night. And when the parents asked them, look, when I was 16, 17, I got my license. I wanted to drive and see my friends. The kid's response was, you know what? I'll stay in tonight and I'll be on the internet and I'll interact with them that way. How do you get over that? How do you convince them that, look, nature is great. Go outside, play.
Well, you have to create those wow experiences that compete with the satisfaction that they're and the inspiration, whatever, that they're getting on their electronics. So, you know, trying to introduce them to a live animal that they've never seen before, or a really cool pond, and do activities that get them engaged and active. is really the way, I think, to do that. And we've been pretty successful with that. I think it just needs to continue.
Scott Chasky, I have to ask you, because I haven't been to your farm. I intend to get there this summer when I do a little bit of traveling, and I'm looking forward to it. Would you describe yourself as an environmental activist? I guess I'm asking this because we have two high school students who are going to be joining us in a minute or two. And I'm wondering if when the youngsters come to your place, do you look at them and say, look, this is your future. This is what you need to do. Let's get moving here.
Yeah, I think we do a little bit more than that, or something a little bit more practical, is we might ask them to help seed. We might, put a fork in their hand and ask them to help dig potatoes, so they're actually experiencing it rather than us just, spouting some wisdom that they may not want to hear. So.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you gentlemen to join in the conversation now with our two high school students. They both go to Sayville High. Lilia Bartolotto and Joanna Ziegler are joining us. Lilia, Joanna, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
I hope I'm not asking you guys to cut class today.
No, we're in spring break.
Oh, you're on break. Okay, good. You're not going to get in trouble. That's excellent.
No.
Tell us what Students for Climate Action is all about. Lilia, let me start with you.
Okay. So we are a nonpartisan group that spans from, we're mostly based in Long Island, but we're part of the New York chapter. And we're a group that works with elected officials to change policy about renewable energy and about environmental action, to try to mandate change in our community. So we're trying to get at least our community to go 100% renewable by 2050.
Hmm. Joanna, what kind of response are you getting from the politicians and the leaders in your communities?
Well, it definitely has been mixed. We've been very blessed to meet with a bunch of elected officials that do give us the time of day and do listen to us and want to work with us. We have gotten some pushback, but I think that as a umbrella statement, I think most politicians we meet with are thinking about changing policy, but we do have a lot of work to do.
Lilia, back in the day when this all started, people who participated in Earth Day events or were environmentalists, some of them were considered by many to be on the fringe of society, and people looked at them as being kind of strange. How would you say your activities are being embraced by other students?
I think that it's a lot more widespread, at least in our generation, because people are realizing how important it is that we save our Earth or preserve it for future generations. Even though, we might not be, the most active, generation, we still care about the Earth a lot. And I think it's environmentalism has been more normalized in our, generation, which has made it a lot more easier for us to gain momentum and kind of try to mandate change in our community. And, the problem is that usually we're elected officials are a bit older, so they're not used to, the environmentalist movement as much, the newer version. So that's where we might, be challenged a little bit to try to, change their minds. But we've met with a lot of amazing progressive elected officials who want to change the environment that we're living in.
That's interesting that you say it's progressives, because, Joanna, I don't know if you heard, but we had Ralph Nader on just a few moments ago. And Ralph Nader was one of those who basically started Earth Day. He wasn't the guy, but he was one of the founders of the environmental movement. And what he said was it's gone mainstream, so it's not so much progressives. But he also had an interesting take. He said the new generation, meaning you, what you need to do is you have to have a laser-like focus, as I believe the words that he used. And he said, go after your politicians. Go after the congressmen. Go after the senators and say, we demand this. It's our future. What do you think of that?
I definitely love that view on it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Joanna. Let's start with you.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no, definitely. That's a great way to put it, because now we, as a group, the youth climate strikes that are going on, there's one next month. There was one about a month ago, I think. And the youth is really getting active in our climate and preserving our environment. I know in our school, a huge thing. It's like, oh, bring your reusable cups, your reusable straws. Everyone, you know, stop the plastics in the ocean. It's all starting from somewhere. So now we're having, with our group, we're more laser focused on climate specifically. But I am seeing a lot of change, and the whole world seeing a lot of change in the way that our generation does view our world and how we need to preserve it. So I think that is a great way to put it.
Mm. Lilia?
I agree with Joanna. It's an, like, it's pretty much just exactly like our cause for this club that we're in. And it just really demonstrates, like, the only way that we can effectively change our community is through government. And, like, the government is supposed to be there for us, for the people to be represented. And as, like, our generation, one of our main concerns, like, as we get older, is becoming the environment. So I think that the government is soon going to start to mirror our concerns as we become the, as we become voters and as we become active members in our community.
Scott Chasky, I'm learning a lot speaking with Lilia and Joanna, and I'm very grateful for that. And I know part of what you do is you try to teach the youngsters who come to Quail Hill Farms. But at the same time, do you ever get an education yourself?
Well, I'm getting one right now. I thought, quite honestly, that I was going to be asked to offer some optimism, but I'm actually leaving. Having listened to Ralph Nader and having listened to these two amazing young people, I'm encouraged and optimistic just because of that. So, yeah, that's what we're trying to spread, and we do it specifically by, well, the farmers are responsible for, you know, planting the plants and doing the seeding, etc. But the members of our farm and anyone who comes to visit actually goes out and does all their own harvesting. So the education involved in actually digging carrots for the first time, or digging potatoes, or cutting flowers, or whatever, is beyond words, really. And so that's the way we've been doing it, and young people always respond to it.
Scott Heth is still with us, the Executive Director of Environmental Learning Centers of Connecticut. And Scott, going on your website and doing a little reading last night, I was struck by the fact that you provided environmental education programs to more than 22,000 children and families from over 70 Connecticut communities in 2018. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot. I just want to commend Lilia and Joanna for their work. You know, and all the programs that we do, you know, we try to mention to people what they can do to help the environment. And that list includes, you know, simple things like turning off the lights and reducing auto use and recycling and composting and all that stuff that is really important. But really at the top of the list is what they're doing, and that's becoming involved with legislation and municipal government to really try to impact change. And I think that they're doing a great job.
Lilia, I'd like to ask you and Joanna, but I'll start with you, Lilia. Do you ever get pessimistic? Because I have to admit that I know some middle-aged people who kind of are like, yeah, it is what it is, and I don't hold out much hope for the future. Do you think that you can do it?
Yeah. So I do experience a lot. Like, it can be very disheartening at times when we keep meeting with elected officials and we're not seeing a lot of action, and we're not seeing, like, a lot of change or acceptance of, like, what we're trying to push. And but I know that, as of now, we're, like, planting the seeds for a greater movement. And I know that as we get older, we're going to try to make the change as we become, like, as we become able to, like, have, like, the resources to make more change. But I also think as, like, time progresses, the effects of climate change are really presenting themselves. And at one point, people just have to stop denying that we are causing this change that's happening to our planet.
Mm. Joanna, do you keep that optimism going?
Yes. It is very easy to get very pessimistic and disheartened, like Lilia said, when we're meeting with elected officials, and it seems as if they just kind of wanted to meet with us because we're progressive youths, and it's put on a pedestal that they like what we're doing, but we don't want just their approval, we want their action. So sometimes when we don't get that action, it's very disappointing. But I like to step back and think that this isn't really about me. This is about, you know, our planet, and this is about, like Lilia said, planting the seed that this isn't just about us. We're doing this for the future. So that's what I like to think about to keep myself from getting too pessimistic. But we have seen a lot of, you know, optimistic things. There's certain policies we've changed in our own town, and we're getting there. So we're just being very patient.
And I'm sure you do remind them that in the very near future, you will be voting, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Scott Chasky, Scott Heth, I have about two and a half minutes left. Scott Chasky, I'd like to start with you. Final thoughts on this Earth Day, something that you would like us to think about, consider for the future, and changes that you would like us to make.
Well, I, after listening to these two wonderful young people, I would say let's back them. Let's help them do whatever they're doing at the moment, and that will carry us forward. You know, I came back from a couple months ago from a trip to Thessaloniki, Greece, with 40 people from 40 different countries practicing community-supported agriculture. No one even knew what that term was 30 years ago. So it's extraordinary what can happen. There are now over 6,000 CSAs in this country, and building community, and that's what your program is doing by bringing these young people, building community, and that's what I want to continue to work on.
Scott Heth, you're going to get the last word today, sir. You have about a minute.
Sure. Well, I want to echo what Scott said early on in this program, is that you know, Earth Day is every day, and we should be thinking about this all the time. And there's a lot of things that we can do right in our backyards and our households to protect the environment. I mentioned some already, like, you know, reducing energy and composting and recycling. It's really important stuff. But also, our backyards provide great habitats for wildlife. To help pollinator species, if you plant native plants in your backyard, you can attract bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, all those types of things which help our environment. So be thinking about what you can do, just simple decisions that you can do in your everyday lives to help protect our environment.
Joanna Ziegler and Lilia Bartolotto are Sayville High School students, members of Students for Climate Action. I want to thank both of you for coming on today. You're both very inspirational, and I wish you the best of success for our future. And trust me, I hope you're successful.
Thank you so much.
Scott Heth is the Executive Director of Environmental Learning Centers of Connecticut, and Scott Chasky is Director of Quail Hill Farms in Amagansett, Long Island, and Senior Advisor at the Peconic Land Trust. And as I said before, please check out their websites. They're fantastic. You'll get a lot of great information. And then somehow this spring, this summer, go visit them. Why not? Scott,
that's right.
Scott, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Happy Earth Day.
Thank you very much.
Happy Earth Day,
yeah,
everyone.
Happy Earth Day to all of you.
Thank you.
Happy Earth Day.
Tomorrow, I just want to say real fast, because I forgot to do this a little bit earlier, we're going to be talking about measles and anti-vax, but more about that later. That is going to be it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, and Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is our producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.